VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hello everyone, this is The Rup from The Times and The Sunday Times. Thanks for joining us and welcome back. And we're in a different location today, guys. We're in London's West End. We can see Chinatown out the window. We've got some big news because you might have heard that this is starting slightly differently because you've all heard a lot about the great producer Alfie. Well, because it's going to be quite busy and because we're going to be all over the place at the World Cup, we've basically anointed the great producer Alfie to becoming the great presenter Alfie. So you've all heard about him, but you might not have heard of him unless you've listened to the adverts on The Ruck, which we're very grateful for.
Are you putting canned applause in here, Alfie? This is what you need.
I know, the takeover is happening. Viva la revolution.
So, oh, French, well done. Without further ado, let's introduce our presenter, Mr. Alfie Reynolds.
How are we, gents? Are we all good?
We're good. Do you need any tips, Alfie? I know you've only done commentary on TalkSport. You've hosted lots of stuff on the radio. But if you need any presenting tips, then just call us up whenever you need.
I will be leaning heavily on all of you. But I'm looking forward to it here, gents. We're here, as you mentioned, Will, on location. We're at Clubhouse 5, which is just off Leicester Square. So if I kind of lean to my right and over Alex's shoulder, I can kind of see someone dressed up as a Pikachu, all the general delights that are in Leicester Square. But Clubhouse 5 have invited us down to host our pre-World Cup pod. As you say, ahead of the World Cup, Will, you guys are going to be so busy out in France, so hectic, that I'll be having a little bit more of an on-air role for the podcast. And that's why we thought we'd kick things off here. And, of course, you've heard from Will, you've heard from Alex. We welcome back Owen Slot as well. How are you, Slotty?
Well, just so excited to be in rocking Clubhouse 5, which is, I mean, the fans are all here screaming to listen to our
we couldn't keep them out of the door, could we?
Bon mot, that's my French.
You picked up from Viva la Revolution and we go
no,
from
No, quite
there.
Right. Let's just, no cul-de-sacs.
Well, listen, looking ahead to the World Cup, there's so much to get into, gents. Before we properly get into things, we're going to look at pools A, pool B, C, D. We're going to look through all of it, maybe some of our hopes for the tournament. And maybe a few predictions as well. You've all covered Rugby World Cups before, so before we fully get into the meat of it, just how are you feeling, generally speaking, ahead of this version in 2023?
I think this will be the best World Cup there's been. I think the competition at the highest, at the top of it, is tighter than ever. You've got Ireland as the world number one team going into it, and they've beaten everyone else, and they've beaten all their big rivals in the last 2 years. But France are hosts. New Zealand with Joe Schmidt on the management team, I think could be an inspired piece of recruitment from them. And we saw South Africa at Twickenham last Friday night just monstering the All Blacks. That side of the draw looks incredible, and the imbalance in the draw is ludicrous in a lot of ways. It was done 3 years ago because they needed to get ticketing in ahead of the Paris Olympics. It won't happen again like this, and it's created a left-hand side of the draw with the top five teams in the world and the right-hand side of the draw with teams 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, which, if you're Scottish or Irish, you're looking at this going, my God, we've got to get two of the top five will make the semi-finals. But if you're looking at it from a neutral perspective, it makes the group stages better than they've ever been, because every group has got jeopardy in it. Even if, you know, I think Italy will struggle to come through Pool A, but we open with France against New Zealand at the Stade de France. I just think that there's even a positive to be taken from the imbalanced draw, that the two sides are pretty level, and so the group stages for once will be fiery from the off. There'll be no slow burn here. It'll be awesome.
I'm really looking forward to it. And I've actually, to everyone else's chagrin, more French.
That's brilliant. Do it again.
We don't have to keep doing French, by the way, gents, just so you know, through the episode. Yeah.
No, but I spent a week in France, and that was
just a holiday.
You notice
the presenter asserting himself there. It's like,
that's how you do it.
Grow up, kids.
Well, I spent a week in France, and before this, just had a break from covering England, which some of us needed. And it's just going to be an awesome tournament. France is going to embrace it amazingly. They've got a really good team, as Alex was saying. I think we'll get onto it, but I think they probably should win it. Slightly reticent to be the man who's going to probably stay with England for most of the tournament, because at the moment they looks quite sad watching them, really. But I've only ever been to one World Cup as a journalist. I've watched plenty on the telly and all that, and that was Japan last time, and that was a mad tournament for lots of different reasons. Lots of us had never been to Japan. It was a different experience working out where the hell you were, or what train line to get, or what colour.
If you're the England man, how long have they put you in for?
Yeah, well, yeah.
It's a very good question.
Have you got a hotel for the quarterfinals?
Nominally, I meant to be there for the whole thing, but there's a point, I was with my girlfriend on holiday, and she's coming out for a small bit in the middle while I'm having a break when England have got 11 days off, and she was like, are you going to come back with me on the Eurostar? Because England will be gone by then. So we'll see. But in general, I think it's going to be an amazing tournament. Let's see how much England take part in it. But it should be really, really fun.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it. It's my first tournament in a media capacity. I was going to call myself a journalist there, but I thought in front of you three, it might kind of get scoffed at.
Come on.
A little bit. But I'm really looking forward to going. I woke up to some trepidation last week, Alex, when I looked at the Times and saw your article about French air traffic control going on strike on the 15th of September, which is when I'm supposed to be flying into Nice for the Wales-Portugal game, the England-Japan game. So I think travel chaos could potentially plague us throughout the World Cup, but we'll wait and see. But as we say, coming up on this episode, we'll preview all the pools at the World Cup during that time. Hopefully, we'll be able to tackle some of the big questions, like can Ireland make it past the quarterfinals? Maybe they could even go on and win it. Will it be a glorious maiden title on home soil for the French? Or possibly, will it be the traditional powerhouses of Springboks and the All Blacks that assert their dominance? Plus, what on earth will England produce? We'll hear more from Will on that, as he's going to be stuck with them. And also, we'll look ahead to the tournament, predictions, hopes of the tournament, all that sort of thing coming up on this week's episode of The Ruck. So let's work through it with Pool A and B first. Starting in Pool A, New Zealand, France, Italy, Uruguay, Namibia. All eyes, Slotty, on this pool are on the opening night, the 8th of September. The French, the home nation, against the All Blacks. We just heard from Will and Alex in terms of how excited they are for this World Cup. That's as good a curtain raiser as we've had for a World Cup, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's the best kickoff ever. I agree with what Alex was saying before. I think this should be the best Rugby World Cup ever for all the reasons he noted, plus the fact that the leading nations are all the brand of rugby that World Rugby's been trying to tempt out of the game, that is sort of edging towards something pretty decent at the moment. You've got lots of nations playing a really good game, and yeah, that opening night, you know, after just what we've seen the last few weeks, I mean, you couldn't get anything better than that.
Is it an oversimplification? I know that's a great opening fixture. I know. Are all of you going to be at that, by the way? Or Will, are you already
Not
in
me,
Marseille?
No.
You're already in
kind
Marseille.
Marseille, yeah.
Alex, Slotty, are you both at that one?
Yeah.
So it's going to be a fantastic occasion. After that game, is Pool A pretty much decided?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Both are going to go through. I mean, poor old Italy, they've, in a different way to Scotland, which we'll get onto. If you're an Italian fan, you're probably like, this is one of the best Italian teams we've ever had. And we get drawn with the All Blacks in France.
Do you not wish we had Italy in the England group? I mean,
yeah.
That would be really
with Paolo Adogwu breaking through the England back line, that would be great fun, wouldn't it? But yes, to answer your question, I think whether New Zealand or France win that first game, they're both going through, aren't they? And then it gets seriously tasty.
But So that's probably the only group where there's less jeopardy, but the result of that opening night has a massive impact on what happens down the line, because Ireland and South Africa and Scotland are battling in their pool, which we'll come to, for the right to play probably the winners of that game, or avoid the winners of that game in the quarters. But the one thing I would say about Pool A is, in these conversations, we always focus on the massive games. France-New Zealand is the biggest opening game that I think we've ever had in a World Cup. But some of the stories, some of the colour, some of the most joyful occasions at a Rugby World Cup come from games like Namibia v Uruguay. And this is and Italy are... They're unfortunate to find themselves in that pool. We saw how well they played against Japan last weekend. They're a team on the rise. They're not going to come out of that group. But I think some of the rugby we'll see, some of the colour, and just some of the storylines that you get from the inverted commas smaller games and the lower ranked teams can often be some of the most enjoyable experiences at a World Cup.
Okay. Just go back to what you said about the jeopardy. So we know that we presume that the All Blacks and France will go through. To what extent do those two nations... how important is it for them to win that game beyond momentum, confidence, that kind of thing? Because they know that their prize at the end of it is South Africa or Ireland. So you would, if I was them, I'd want to win because you're more likely to play Ireland in the next round. I mean, is that what we're saying? That's how important it is.
I would suggest it's important for France to keep winning at home. Because I think, in the last 23 matches, they've won 22 at home. The one they lost was to Scotland in the Six Nations when it was behind closed doors during COVID. To keep that kind of air of this is a very difficult French team to beat at home for this tournament would probably be my counter-argument to that.
Yeah, and for the tournament, if France were to open it with a big victory over the All Blacks at the Stade de France, you just feel it would lift. It's exactly the kickoff that the World Cup would want. It won't. I don't think it'll lose anything if they were to lose that day, because this is a 2-month event and there's a long time for people to stay excited. But if they win it, like just reading John Westerby's piece, I don't know if anyone's read his brilliant.
That was awesome, wasn't it? Yeah.
Spent 2 or 3 days down in the village where Antoine Dupont is from, like really getting into the heart and soul of French rugby. I'd advise anyone to go and read it. It's a brilliant piece because it's so evocative about what this tournament will do. And it places you in these villages in the south of France where rugby is everything. And if France were to open the tournament with a big win on the Friday night, a statement victory, the whole place will be nuts. It'd be like if anyone's been on the Tour de France, you follow the Tour de France, it's the villages get taken over. There's a spirit of joy about it. And the whole place will be electrified if France win that. So from a rugby perspective, it's important because they'll want to finish first and they might get Ireland if we think South Africa are going to beat Ireland. But from a tournament perspective, which is what we're all interested in particular, it would just electrify the whole thing if they were to open it with a win.
Yeah, I was just wishing I'd say what Alfie said because he's the presenter and smart. But also, I'm thinking back to 2007, the opening game, France lost to Argentina, didn't they, by 5 or 6 points or something. And that's kind of sucked something out of the event. So, as you say, you kind of want them to win just to really sort of maximise everything that we're looking forward to.
I was going to mention that too, because I guess you were there, Slotty, were you? Or
I wasn't at that game, but I was...
You were at the World Cup, yeah. Because I was just thinking, none
and
of the coaches...
You were still at school.
Yeah, I was, yeah. I literally was. none of the coaches or none of the players in this French setup were involved in that, but there must be a sense from the FFR that they need to nail it, because the last time they hosted the tournament they lost to Argentina, they then lost to them again, didn't they, later in the tournament to come fourth.
Yeah, they did, but the tournament was good.
Yeah, but from the French perspective, nailing that first thing.
For all the controversies around France being the host this time, getting the tournament ahead of South Africa, Bernard Laporte's involvement, I think they'll be the perfect hosts, but they have worked incredibly well to align the entire nation behind it, which has never happened before. You've never had the top 14 and the French national team working in consort as they are now. The whole pyramid of the game in France is geared around this tournament. And so while that would make a massive difference if France were to win it, and they're in a wonderful position to do it, I think the tournament will thrive anyway because the nation's been prepared so well to host it.
Also, I suppose that I think you mentioned this on a pod we did a few weeks ago, Alex, that France can take heart from South Africa's experience last time, is that if they actually do lose the opening game, it is now possible to win the World Cup. Well, someone's done it before, and in exactly the same way, lose to New Zealand on the opening night.
And we're going to go through the pools here, but we're talking about the left-hand side of the draw. It's stacked. Can anyone win 7 straight games when, you know, if you take Pool B, which we'll come to, where, let's say, Ireland... Will they beat Scotland and South Africa, and then a quarterfinal, semi-final, final.
Isn't there a big conversation in here about whether you throw a game is the wrong thing, but if you've won enough to be confident you're going to go through, then do you sacrifice a later massive clash? That'd be in the pool B, wouldn't it? If you're so if you're Ireland and you've already beaten South Africa, for instance, and then you've got Scotland in your last round, do you put in your B team?
Does that have shades of, I'm thinking back to the Football World Cup 2018? Southgate, yeah. They sort of didn't want definitely to lose to Belgium, but they didn't try that hard to beat them, did they, in the pool? And then they got a really easy draw, was it via Colombia and Sweden, and then ended up playing Croatia in the semi and lost. And so you thought,
and no one gave them any credit because they got an easy ride. So we could do the same for Ireland if they do that. They're not really world champions. And maybe had an easy World Cup.
Again, we're sort of jumping between pools a bit, but I feel like particularly with Ireland, just because they've never had a run in a World Cup, and I know, again, lots of different players, lots of similar players, different coaching setup, you think they can't be overthinking it and throwing games. They've just got to throw everything at it. Like maybe possibly South Africa, but you just can't see them, although canny as Razzie and Jacques Nienaber are, you can't see someone actively wanting to lose.
Well, we'll get on to Ireland in a minute. I would say, just on your point, Slotty, I look at Pool B, and we will come on to it. There's a good chance, I think, that Ireland, South Africa, Scotland, it could be a pool where they all end up with the same amount of wins, and it works out that way, which might... points difference, exactly. Just staying on Pool A for just a second, I want to move on to the All Blacks, because I think they're a fascinating case, particularly after what we saw a week or so ago at Twickenham against the Springboks. Just a final one on France. How heavily would you have France in the favourites conversation if it wasn't at home? Are they still right up there for all of you, or do you think home advantage plays a big part?
Definitely, yeah, definitely. And I think basically the only games they've lost of note recently have been to Ireland, and in Dublin to Ireland. They smashed the All Blacks the last time they played them in France, albeit the All Blacks just got battered by the Springboks, but they look a better All Black team than they did in 2022, didn't they, and 2021. I would say so. What do you think, Alex?
Yeah, definitely. I think they are a genuine contender wherever it's played, and the challenge that Fabien Galthié and his coaching staff have is to ensure that the home advantage becomes an advantage.
And not a pressure.
And just from watching their game against Australia, I think they'll feed off it. Everything we've seen, when we saw them win the Grand Slam, they beat England at home, they just fed off that stage. They're a young team who feels really France 98 to me. It feels there's a nation behind them. They're a young team. This is their time. I'm not necessarily saying I think they'll win, but I think they will tap into the fact they're at home and use that to their advantage. But it's, which comes back to winning the first game. Like, if they can do that, then the place will go nuts, and they can thrive off it.
So isn't it the whole mentality the way that Galtier's tried to prepare them psychologically is, he divorced this new team from the old team post 2019 World Cup into 2020 Six Nations, and everyone's going, oh, he's gone mad, he's picked this ludicrously young team. He basically he chopped off the legs of the old team, all the players who had a history of underperforming or a history of anxiety and not having the right sort of the famous flaky French mentality. He just got rid of that lot. And these boys playing now, they're the teams that have won, and as the juniors, and over 4 years we've seen them again and again. We said, oh, are they going to have that flaky French thing? And they haven't once done that. They won a Grand Slam, they've done the whole lot. So I don't see why the home World Cup should be the one where they finally display what we dismiss as stereotypical French rugby behaviour.
I completely get what you're all saying. The reason I asked it, actually, and I could be completely wrong here, this can be my first kind of big opinion with hosting the Ruck, and it will fall on its face and everyone will be like, well, what on earth does he know? I just feel like France haven't been playing as well as they did when they won the Grand Slam at the start of 2022 for a while. I know they've still been winning, but I'm not sure their performances have quite been at that level, which is why I asked the question. But I think Elgin Alderman said on last week's podcast, this is a French team that have everything in place to go and win the World Cup in terms of the way the fans are behind them, in terms of the team that Fabien Galthié and his coaching staff have put together. So I do get where you're coming from. Let's move on to the All Blacks, because as I said previously, I think they're really interesting. I watched them in the Rugby Championship and thought, okay, the All Blacks look back here, particularly that first 20 minutes against the Springboks, and then they absolutely got it handed to them on Friday night the other week at Twickenham. Where are we with this All Blacks team and how good they are? Any scars from that defeat to the Springboks? How are you all viewing them?
So I've had to write 1,600 words on this for, for our pullout, which we're pre-recording this, so came out on Saturday, we'll say. And it's a really weird one to talk through, I think, because with any comparison you're making between what is currently the All Black team, you're comparing it to basically the greatest team that's ever played rugby, the one that came before it, the sort of 2011 to 2015 lot. And we've got episodes coming up, our How to Win the World Cup special, there's your plug. We'll get Slotty's book plug in a bit later, but...
Let's go on to plugs now. Come on, let's get it all out of the way. So you've got a series on how to win a World Cup.
Yeah, we do, yeah.
And that's fantastic.
We spoke to you on it as well at some point.
So you did.
Do you remember? Yeah.
No, that's the
Lalio.
Yeah, the
great episode.
The listeners won't have heard that episode yet.
Not yet.
But you're right.
What I'm going to say is that we've got Conrad Smith coming later, who talks about 2011 and 2015. And he made a really fascinating point, I thought, which was essentially that this era are more fearful of the Northern Hemisphere sides than his lot ever were, and for good reason, because he was saying his lot worried about South Africa periodically because their rivalry waxed and waned a bit over their era, but they didn't lose them that often, really. And Australia they worried about a bit because of sort of the little brother, big brother thing. But that was kind of it across the world. They didn't have to deal with a brilliant England. They didn't have to deal with... They'd never lost to Wales, they'd never lost to Ireland, they'd never lost to Scotland, France were no good. They'd beat them every now and then, but not much. So
he said it was harder for the current All Blacks,
yeah, that's
it?
What yeah. I mean. So as in that these guys have now got a tougher rugby scene, so maybe the fact that they were pretty poor and lost 7 of 12 tests between 21 and 22 is a reflection more of the scene around the world than necessarily the All Blacks being absolutely terrible.
What I'm interested in about the All Blacks is that after 19, when Steve Hansen said that he felt they were good enough to win the World Cup, but they didn't. They opted not to change a huge amount. Steve Hansen retired and Ian Foster stepped up. Different people, but not dissimilar characters. I think Steve Hansen's probably got a better sense of humour, but really, they're not that different. They'd worked together for so long. Now, in a lot of senses, that continuity is what it's what unions want. They want to know the succession plan. But I just wonder whether the way that New Zealand had dominated the world for 8 years and then didn't win the 19 World Cup, whether that was an opportunity to just veer off in a slightly different direction, bring some more energy to it. And it really felt to 2021, they were struggling and Ian Foster was a game away from being sacked and Scott Robertson had been lined up to take over. They've pulled it around, but I just wonder whether they're quite as advanced as they have been in the past. And that's where I go back to what I said at the start. Joe Schmidt's involvement could be the difference, because I don't think under the management team that they had, there was enough fresh thought and ideas. It was continuation of everything that had been successful, but it needed a step change.
So one thing I discussed in this piece, which is a maybe slightly half-baked theory, but I feel like it's got some legs, is that I think that COVID affected New Zealand more than they might admit or others have realised, because literally it isolated them. They were only playing against themselves for a year, really. They had North-South games and they had Super Rugby among each other. So they were sort of entrenching all of the ideas. Yeah. And yeah, the Crusaders have never had a challenger. They've won 7 editions of whatever Super Rugby's been called over that period. They also then lost the South Africa tests for a whole year and all of the Northern Hemisphere tests where they might have tried different things or played a different way. They also lost the Super Rugby franchises from South Africa who moved to the URC and the Jaguares who had made the 2019 final of Super Rugby. So you're suddenly almost like the lockdown locked them into their own islands and played a bit of Trans-Tasman stuff with Australia, but possibly meant that they were slower. Mm. When they came out of COVID, the European teams had been playing each other a bit more and France and Ireland had grown a bit and they were left behind and then got beaten by them. And so now they're sort of expediting the process a bit quicker.
I think the All Blacks will be backing themselves, particularly after what happened at Twickenham, to maybe potentially try and surprise a few people on that opening night. Let's move on, though. Just a final word on that pool, obviously, for Italy, as we've mentioned already. Lots of hope for them, but it's going to be a difficult one to get out of. And Alex, you were right, I think, to point out Uruguay and Namibia. It might not be the glamour story of this group, but when they meet on the 27th of September for both nations, that is a massive fixture that I'm really looking forward to. Loads more to get into on today's pod, though. So next up, we'll get into Pool B. Pool B. Into Pool B, South Africa, Ireland and Scotland. Those will probably be the teams that will be grabbing the headlines and a lot of people's interest. Also Tonga and Romania. The group of death, gents, it's a group of almost... Where on earth do we start with this pool? We mentioned it already and how tight and competitive it's going to be. I'm happy to leave it open to you guys. Ireland, South Africa, Scotland, your thoughts. Where do we want to go with this one?
This is the hardest World Cup pool of all time. Discuss.
Yeah, because even Tonga, because of World Rugby's law, eligibility law change, they're stronger than they've ever been because they have Charles Piatau, a fullback, Malachi Fekitoa, an outside centre, to name just two. Like they,
Adam Coleman, second row.
Like that's nous. A lot of these the Pacific Islands teams often they play on instinct. They play how they're brought up to play. I had a wonderful chat with Stephen Luatua about what it's like playing for the local village in Samoa. You just play like there. It's just hard. You know, you've got to earn your stripes physically, and that's how Samoa play. Often it's the game management. We talked with Fiji the other week against England. But if you get some top level All Blacks and Wallabies into that team, Tonga will be better than, arguably better than ever, and yet they've landed in a group where you think the best they can do is come fourth out of five, because you've got Scotland who are fifth in the world, and then you've got Ireland who are number one, and South Africa who are the reigning champions.
But on your hardest group ever, I mean, that's a bit harsh on England in 2015 when they had Wales and Australia, isn't it? I mean,
well, England very good, though. They could be classed as a not very good team at that point, maybe.
They used to come second a lot.
Yeah.
But they just came third in that group.
But the fourth team in that group was Fiji, who England put four tries on the opening night.
I take your point. I'm just teasing them, really.
The thing that I'm looking forward to the most, maybe, in this pool is Scotland. I just think that could be so fun, because they've got a style that they are really enjoying playing that is very good, successful and different to South Africa and Ireland. And they can, I reckon they can, they might not, but they can be either of those teams. Mm. And then, as you mentioned before, Alfie, huge banana skin that throws it all out, and then it's suddenly like a points race against Tonga or Romania for the others.
What's also, I think, been interesting with this pool is the way in which teams have use their World Cup warm-ups, in that South Africa and Scotland, because they meet on the opening weekend, have had to basically try and go fully loaded and be fully ready to go for the opening weekend, whereas Ireland have chopped and changed. Johnny Sexton will return for their opening match against Romania. Then they've got Tonga, so they've got time to try and ease their way into the tournament as well.
I don't think Scotland can beat South Africa. I think that physically they just cannot match that. But I have every confidence that they... Well, I think they will beat Ireland, but that Scotland-Ireland game, if it was played five times, I reckon they might win two of them. You know, I think there are some decent odds, and the World Cup brings a whole new mentality to it. Ireland will be absolutely terrified of going down and underperforming, as their World Cup history shows, and it kind of Scotland have got everything to play for.
The thing that we should get Mark Palmer on to talk more about Scotland, but the thing that excites me about Scotland is that they are committed to the way they're going to play. I don't think they'll beat South Africa, but I think the way they play gives them a chance. It's not quite the ruck and run rugby of Japan that saw them beat South Africa in 2015, but they will play wide, they'll play fast, they've got pace, they've got invention. It requires it to work, and it requires them to have some kind of a foothold up front.
I'm sort of thinking that this is the Scots will hate this, but I'm thinking back to South Africa, Japan in the last World Cup, when Japan were fast, quick, did all those sort of things that actually got under the skin of a lot of other nations, and the Springboks come along and just go, sorry.
Demolish them.
But then I'm thinking...
That's quite possible, but all I'm saying is I like the fact that Scotland know who they are, and they're not going to do... Like, I think if England played South Africa, England would just go, right, we're going to have to try and match them up front, and then they'd get blown away.
Yeah.
At least Scotland, who, by the way, have some like serious
big
forwards...
Big units, yeah.
That's not... They have another idea. They're going to go about this in their way with Finn Russell at 10, for example. Like, they're going to try and play. They're going to try and beat them. And I like the idea that Scotland will go into that game and go out and try and beat them rather than try not to get demolished.
You don't think Finn Russell's going to say, come on, we can take him up front?
But that's what I was going to mention. When you said, oh, you're thinking about South Africa, Japan, I'm thinking about the third test of the Lions, which you were at, Slossy, the behind closed doors Lions 21, where Dan Bigger goes off early for an HIA, and Finn Russell comes on, and he suddenly go, oh my God, it could have been so different. Yeah. Like all these suddenly attacking shape comes to the running lines, like different forward pack maybe, but you just sort of think, with Finn Russell there is a chance. Like, I don't think
and
they will beat
them.
And
a second ball player at 15, which Stuart Hogg...
Blair Kinghorn's better
for
fit.
For his qualities, yeah. I think Blair Kinghorn actually is better for Scotland.
I also think psychologically it's really interesting for Scotland because of what we've spoken about, in that, yes, they're in a group where they could look at it and be like, blimey, how have we ended up in this group? But in a way, it takes the pressure off them. There's not that pressure on them where you need to get to a quarterfinal. Most people probably aren't expecting them to get out of this group, which I think maybe frees them up, Alex, to play the brand of rugby that they want to play. We're going to have to move on, guys, just because we are running out of time. We could probably spend ages on all of these pools. Just finally on Pool B, Scotland, Ireland, South Africa. Who have you all got coming out of it? Is it the Ireland and South Africa? Can you see Scotland causing an upset?
I'm going South Africa top the group, Ireland second just. But they could lose to Scotland on that last day and it go down to points difference.
Yeah, I'm completely with that. It's so exciting. It's as you say, you don't tend to have these conversations about the group stages of a Rugby World Cup. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I think, you know, you sneak a losing bonus. Scotland get a losing bonus against South Africa.
I forgot about bonus points.
A month later, that could be critical. You know, when Ireland play Scotland on October the 7th, in a head-to-head to qualify for the quarterfinals. I mean, that's mega.
Just one final thing, I think, as well, to flag with the fixtures. Ireland have their two-week break as well, don't they, between the Springbok game and the Scotland game as well. So I think in terms of the fixtures of that group, actually for Ireland, it's probably worked out the best for, in that they've got Tonga and Romania first, then the Springboks, and then the two-week break.
I love all this talk of the two-week breaks. You sort of imagine them sort of going off to the Maldives or something.
Putting their
cocktails for a bit.
But yeah. The reality might be that the Springboks have beaten them up so savagely with a 7-1 bench. They've got no forwards left, so they need 2 weeks to get a whole load of new ones out.
Quite possibly. Maybe I was looking to be too positive. Right, moving on. Next up, we'll get stuck into Pool C.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Okay, on to Pool C, Wales, Australia, Fiji, Georgia and Portugal. We've just been talking about Pool B as the group of death. For a different way, maybe because some of the sides aren't as good quality, this is another pool of death.
I love this pool.
Yeah.
I love this one because we start with Portugal. The very fact that they're there and the way they got there with the last minute, last kick penalty to draw with the USA in the repechage tournament to qualify. And then on the ruck, we had Thomas Appleton 2 days later, who was back at work at a hospital in Lisbon. I just love the fact they're even there. Then you've got Fiji, who we've all seen how dangerous they are. And actually, in the kind of the received wisdom is you need 5 world-class players in a team. Fiji have got more world-class players, I think, than any other team in that group. You could know, most of them are in the backs, but they've got a collection of players that would walk in to the Australia team and the Wales team. So that's thrilling. And I actually think that although they're seen as they're the third seeds, they are a serious quarterfinal team. Then you've got Georgia with their wonderfully bearded, mustachioed props who drove Wales into the ground in Cardiff last November. They monstered them. You know, they will be loving the idea of taking on the Wallabies, who do have, for once, a prop who might make a World 15 conversation.
Bell.
Angus Bell, hell of a player, but he can't do it on his own. The Georgians have got about 15 of them. Georgia are going to be there going, we can take the Wallabies, we can take Wales. And that's before you get to Wales and Australia, what they do to each other. I love this pool because there's so many narratives around it. You've got the new coaches in Wales and Australia, which is a whole other story. It's probably my favourite pool, really, because of everything that's possible.
The please write us off pool, isn't it?
No one wants to win. Everyone, like, they're all competing with the All Blacks at being under the radar.
We're so bad.
England have played themselves under the radar.
Why are you being so negative, mate?
At some point, our new presenters can say, who do you think is going to win the pool? I haven't got a clue.
Georgia.
I don't have a clue. I think it could well be Fiji win the pool. The Fiji we saw at the weekend are just going to get better. I mean, there's so many reasons why they're going to get better.
I would love that. Like, I remember we did our turn of the year pod that was looking back at 22 and forward to 23. And I think we all did like a New Year's resolution of what we'd like to see happen in 23. And mine was, I would love Fiji to have a properly good run at the World Cup. Like, how good would that be if they won the pool and then beat England in the quarterfinal or something? You just go, wow.
Do you think, though, that despite where Wales and Australia are, which is clearly not a great place in terms of performances and results, that Warren Gatland in particular, but probably Eddie Jones as well, will back themselves to be able to engineer a game plan to see their teams through to a quarter final, whatever that might look like in terms of the style of rugby they play?
You've got two captains of efficiency there, so yes, that is a winning argument. But at the same time, you've got Fiji, who have this ludicrous wealth of talent that captains of efficiency sometimes can fail to contain.
Well, I was thinking about this. I think I read about it in Rugby World. Ken Owens did a column about it and talked about Fiji, because obviously it's Wales' first game. And I was covering Wales largely at the last World Cup, and they played them in, I think, their second game. And they were all over the place at the start, because Tua Sova literally ran over Josh Adams about four times. Semi Radradra was at his peak then, where he's maybe slightly dipped after a couple of seasons at Bristol. And they had to revert to, okay, shut this game down, set piece and all that. And they had a team that could do that then with Alan Wynne-Jones and all that lot, whereas I don't think they do anymore. They certainly don't have as good a front row. They've got a lot of callow younger players in the group too. So actually, that is a huge banana skin for them in the first game. And I'm not sure they can necessarily just go, cool, we'll just go to the line out, the scrum, kick for territory, and we'll win the game.
I think the thing with Fiji is they've got, as we said, they've got the back division to scare anybody in the world. Mark Evans was on the pod recently, wasn't he, talking about they've got 2 years now of Fiji Drua playing professional rugby. They can play strategy. They've got forwards who can, I mean, the line out at Twickenham was a disaster area. Imagine how dangerous they'd have been if they'd actually had a line out to play off. There's a bit more order to them. Mark's view is there'll be some benefit of this World Cup. The main benefit of the Drua will be in 4 years' time. They still need to string performances together, but we know how dangerous they can be. They beat England without Lavani Bhotia and Tua Sova. Their talent outside the pack is extraordinary. They've got a 10 who can kick goals. And they've got forwards who can... I mean, they dealt with England's morning game pretty well. They're a threat. But I'm fascinated to what Eddie does and what Gatland does.
One thing that I'm so interested about this pool or Fiji / Samoa and Tonga is, to what extent does the psychology of being the underdog team play here? To what extent does the psychology, the fact that these players aren't going to get rich on the back of this? Welshmen and Australians are on a decent buck, whatever happens. The English players are on a decent buck, whatever happens. Fiji and the other Pacific Islanders, they're playing for passion and for national pride and all these things that we don't know how much they've been jaded in the what we traditionally call historically call the first tier countries. So they've actually got something different. You said it 4 years ago. South Africa came with something different. The World Cup meant something more to them than England in the final and probably lots of others. And I wonder if that applies here.
I think your question about what does Jones bring and what does Gatland bring? The higher purpose for Australia is that, the funny thing is, he would never have done this if he was still England coach.
Yeah.
But he's gone to Australia and he's seen the team they had with Quade Cooper and Michael Hooper, who is injured, but you wonder whether he'd have made it anyway, and gone, well, we're not winning the World Cup with these guys. We've got a Lions tour in 2 years' time and a home World Cup in 4 years' time. So I'm just going to rip the plaster off and pick the kids. They've got a fly half who doesn't kick goals in Super Rugby, kicked his first ever penalty playing in a Bledisloe Cup game against the Wallabies.
And he's the only fly half.
And he's the only fly half. Like, I'm amazed they didn't bring Bernard Foley or someone as a steady squad mentor. But Eddie's just gone, well, those lot weren't going to win it. And we've got more to aim for beyond this World Cup. So let's just go for it and see.
Is that what it's all about then? Because Eddie Jones keeps saying, we've got a plan to win the World Cup, as you guys would have heard multiple times when he was in charge of England. For Australia, this is about the Lions tour and a World Cup in 4 years' time.
I think there are parallels with France at the last World Cup, where Galtier was on that coaching team. He wasn't the head coach, but there was he was formulating plans for 4 years hence. And I think that's exactly what Eddie Jones has done. He's really ripped the plaster off. And Gatland has done it in a semi-way. He's put a few senior players out to pasture. There are still a couple of senior players there, but the accent of that Wales squad is now youth. That's Jack Morgan, Dowie Lake, co-captains. He's ripped out a lot of experience because he also looked at it and was like, well, these guys won't do it, so we might as well go for it. And where I find it interesting is that England have taken the other approach and they've retained all their veterans, of underperforming veterans of 19, in a hope of muddling through. So all I can say, that your question was, do they have a game plan to make a quarter? I think it's more that they've decided that what existed before, what Gatland and Jones, before they took over, they decided, well, that lot isn't going to do it. So our best bet is to bring in the youth and have a crack.
So if you're a team facing some rampaging Fijians, are you better equipped to deal with them if you've got experience and now, but maybe slightly jaded players? That's a vague reference to England. Or if you're young and you've not seen the world and you haven't, and you're not so scared like the Welshman and the Australian and the Wallabies.
I think it's slight contradiction from what I said before about Wales maybe not having the game that they could shut it down like they did in 2019. But I think they will be better equipped for a Fiji game than Australia will be, for the because they've got the likes of a 9 and 10 with loads of caps, like Dan Bigger, Gareth Davis, Thomas Williams, those guys. And they've got at least some experience of Lions Test, Liam Williams, Josh Adams, Halfpenny around the group. Whereas Aussie, you've got absolutely zero. They've got nothing.
I'll tell you what's fascinating for me about the Wallabies. And Eddie Jones has come in to be their head coach, as much to try and sell the sport back to the Australian public as anything else. They'll go into their opening game against Georgia having lost 5 out of 5. They got 40 points put on them by France on last weekend in the final warm-up game. But by having picked the kids, there's a whole different perspective around that team. It's like we can see Carter Gordon understanding a bit more how to play Test rugby. It completely changes the conversation around what Australia are. If they'd gone there with Test Centurions in that team and conceded 40, the conversation would have to have been like it has been with England, which is this all there is? He's actually totally changed the perspective on what Australia can do, which is, well, let's have a go. And I was fascinated by the commentary around that heavy defeat by France, which is actually more positive than we've seen, say, with England, who've lost 3 out of 4 warm-up games and barely a positive to be found.
I think you could say the same about Wales as well. The perception of where that team is compared with England again is completely different. Also, I think we need to move on to England's pool, but something we've kind of touched upon talking about this pool and throughout is styles of rugby. And I think that's going to be something that's fascinating in this World Cup, just looking at this pool. Georgia in a tight game, they'll have a game plan that can possibly get them results. Fiji, obviously, we know the style of play they play. Scotland, we spoke about in the last group with looking to, I think there's so many teams with really interesting different styles of rugby in this World Cup, which will be really, really interesting. Let's get on to the final pool, Pool D and England. England, Japan, Argentina, Samoa, Chile. Guys, you spend a lot of time in the England camp, chatting to the England camp. How would you just assess the mood of where this England team is on the eve of a World Cup?
Do you want to go for it first?
Is that a horrible question just
chuckle,
to throw you away?
It's not funny. It's never been worse.
We're not going to lose lots of listeners at this point.
I think this is probably what they're here for, in all honesty.
Tell a joke or something. Go on.
It's never been worse.
It's quite sad. Like I wasn't at the last game because I was away and you did it, but I was at the Ireland one, and my Monday piece after that was sort of trying to reflect the sort of... I just felt depressed watching an England sporting team and sad. Like, it was just less sort of embarrassing, and it sounds like one of those ones where you're like, I'm not angry, I'm disappointed, which is all a bit teachery, isn't it? But it is just so sad watching how bad they are.
I think the thing is, Alfie, that it's like the England team. We've got Alex and Will here. They're like jaded, old, campaigners, and they got nothing cheerful left in them. And I'm going to march into Marseille on Saturday week and be full of jokes.
You're going to be Alex Mitchell.
How great they are.
Up the tempo.
And everyone's going to go, thank goodness we got Slotty on it.
That's what they'll be saying with you back on this episode as well. That was why we had to get you
but
in.
It is interesting. Like, what is there? So World Cup warm-ups are pre-season games, and usually they're just treated in exactly that way. In the situation that England are in with a new, relatively new coaching team and a Six Nations that still ended with another 2 wins out of 5 record for the third year in a row, these warm-up games were much more important than they usually are. And, I mean, there was the calamity of red cards. There were the unfortunate to lose two frontline players to injury. You know, whether you out there would have Jack Van Poortvliet as your scrum half or not, we think Steve Borthwick would have done. So Steve Borthwick will go into the opening game without his captain, his first choice number 8, his first choice scrum half, and one of the England players who is capable of delivering world class performances in Anthony Watson. So it's been a month of calamity.
Maybe Tom Curry as well.
Maybe Tom Curry. I mean, there's all sorts of shadiness around injuries, but where are the positives for anyone to grab onto? And where's, you know, we saw the set piece improve a bit in the Six Nations from where it was, but it couldn't get any worse. It did get better, but now that looks shaky. The attacking game is clunky and inaccurate. They can't convert pressure into points at all. It's like you're desperately hoping to find something to grab onto, and really the only thing left is that Alan Walters, the fitness guru, has got a master plan all along, and they're going to emerge out of this conditioning block and be like superheroes against Argentina. Like, there's literally nothing else to hold on to unless he rips off the plaster within the squad he's got.
Well, you all did a piece in the Times last week about how to fix England. What does a good World Cup for England look like?
Well, you say, what does it look like now? I would say that a good World Cup for England should always be semi-final. Like, I'm not saying they have a divine right to be there, but with the investment that they make and the resources, playing resources, talent, like, England should always be competing for a place in the final, in my view. Where they are now, at the start of this month, you're like, this is not... You'd say that this group didn't have enormous jeopardy on it. There were some trickier games, but England and Argentina will go through. Now, a month later, I think you're thinking Samoa with Stephen Lua-Tua, and that on the last game is a majorly treacherous game for England. A good result for England is to get to the semi-finals.
Can I flip it another way, which is maybe putting our journalism hats on again? At what point are we genuinely going to have a conversation about Steve Borthwick's future? Is there any scenario where he actually could lose his job? Like, if England lose in the pool,
really? Do we have to do that?
I know we don't want to, and like people go, "Are you being negative and everything else?" But
is that a conversation for later?
Possibly no. But all I'm thinking is, if they don't make it out of the easiest pool that they've possibly ever had, that is,
he's absolutely right.
Horrendous, isn't it?
It's not.
We don't want people to get sacked, but that will be a conversation topic. At the end of September.
Let's be clear. We've said this beforehand. We'd rather England do well than do badly.
That's, absolutely, yeah.
Despite how it may sometimes appear in the media. But yeah, the direction of travel is disaster. And at the end of disaster, people lose their heads. I mean, I hope that doesn't happen. But
I think maybe there's the context. So for the Six Nations, I think fans and journalists and lots of people would have given Borthwick a complete pass and just said he was appointed a month before, had a week before with the team, and try and do what you can. Didn't have his coaches, exactly. Whereas now you're looking at it and you're going, okay, it's still not that long, but Simon Raoulouis had less time with Fiji. They've now had 9 tests under Borthwick. He's picked exactly the squad he wanted. He's got exactly the coaching staff he wanted. He's got the best fitness coach in the world, he says, and the second best fitness coach in the world, he says, Adam Walters and Tom Tombolson. He's got the most experienced England squad that they've ever put together. And they lost to Fiji at home. So you're sort of like, all the goodwill has been lost over the last 4 weeks, hasn't it, Alex?
If England were to lose to Argentina and Samoa, I mean, Japan got got thumped pretty comfortably by Italy. It doesn't look like Japan are the team at this World Cup that they have been at the two previous World Cups. So I think what we're talking about here is, could England lose to Argentina and Samoa? If they do, in some ways, Steve Borthwick, having been hired for 5 years, he won't have advanced the team in any way. They'll have gone backwards. But as anyone who's read the Times in the last 2 weeks, if not longer, there's a massively bigger conversation here about, you know, the bloke who hired him in the first place, the structure within which they work, the pathways that the RFU have allowed to be destroyed over a number of years. There's a much bigger conversation that would need to happen, and actually does need to happen regardless. Much bigger than just, do we sack Steve Borthwick and hire Ronan O'Gara? There's so much more here. I still think England will make the quarterfinals. I still think that by the time they make that Argentina, the Samoa game, sorry, on the last round of the pool matches, they'll have enough about them to beat Samoa and make the quarterfinals. And then I'm not confident that they'd get any further than that. But I'm not sure, a year ago when England were still losing, that I'd have thought they'd have got much further than that.
Can I just make a quick other point? I agree completely with all of that. What I was just going to add was that it's actually really, really difficult for England to get knocked out of the pool, because it also needs whoever they lose to win all of their other games. So, like, if they lose to Japan, Japan have then also got to beat two other teams, or Samoa. So they are, even if they do lose to Samoa, which I don't think they will, Samoa have then also would have had to have beaten Chile, which they probably will, and also Japan. So you're kind of thinking, there's so much in there for England. They could fall into the quarterfinal, and then it's a fun game against either Wales, Australia, or Fiji.
Well, the point I was just making there about how does he change it. So Alfie mentioned we were all asked to come up with an idea of what could change within 2 weeks, and what I had two thoughts I shared, but one of them was selection. There are England players who are being picked at the moment regardless of performance. Like, Freddie Stewart is nailed on to play at 15. Mario Itoje is nailed on to play in the second row.
Just really quickly, Alex, this was going to be the next point I came on to. Of, you look at that England team, what are the best combinations? Who starts where? I think there's so much uncertainty, which is obviously kind of what you're saying in terms of who.
Yeah,
he
but his, and his instinct has been to stick with the players he knows, either the players he played with or has coached before. It all looks to me a bit too comfortable. We're hearing interesting little snippets from in the camp. After a month of anyone who criticised England would be told by Kevin Sinfield or Richard Wigglesworth, well, you should watch us in training because it all looks amazing.
Largely not allowed to.
Which we're not allowed to, so it's a very easy out. Until they lose to Fiji and George Ford says, do you know what, training's not been very good. We're not consistent enough, we make too many mistakes. You're like, wow. You know, who that comment is aimed at, whether it's at the players for not driving the standards or at the coaches for the quality of training, it's unsure. Courtney Law's saying there are conversations about trying to change the game plan to bring the best out of the players. So they don't have what they need to play the game that he wants to play. But to play a game that might suit them, they don't have the time to implement it. So they are stuck. And I just think one of the only ways to do it is to actually put some pressure on the players who are currently being picked automatically. And go, well, do you know what, maybe we should play George Martin and Ollie Chessam in the second row because they are playing better and they're hungrier. And it's almost tapping into what we spoke about earlier in the other group, the Wales and Australia group. Pick some players who are hungry, who might go and do something. It feels to me there are a lot of players very comfortable for their positions at the moment.
But this is what I feel like I've been making this point, or trying to, on the pod ever since I started at the Times. This is where I feel like these players now, quite a lot of them, is going to be their last World Cup. Like, we don't need to go through the whole lot, but there'll be a lot of them that won't play at another one. So they can't just dribble through it and just go, oh, well, it wasn't the game plan that suited us, or wasn't that on board with a sort of Leicester series game plan. Like, take ownership. Get on with it. You don't have to fully 07 it and go full Lawrence Dallaglio and just be like, right, thanks, Brian Ashton, but we're going to do it ourselves. But you've got to think that there's enough in there, enough character and enough nous and knowledge and rugby intellect to go, firstly, have an adult conversation with coaches that a lot of them know well because they played with them or have been coached by, and say, how can we resolve this together? But also just to say, look, we're good enough as a group to sort this out ourselves. We don't actually need all this detail. We can just go and play.
And on that positive note, see you in Marseille. Slotty. This weekend. Slotty, do you want to round us off on England before we get on to some of our hopes for the tournament and predictions? Just quickly, it is fascinating, though, this whole conversation about England on the eve of a World Cup, the whole tone of it, which is the right tone, because, and it's a tone that's reflective of the fans.
Slotty has just published a book, as we record it.
Come on, today, Alex, here we go.
Today is publication day of The Boys of Winter that Owen has written with Lawrence
Lally. Available in all good bookshops.
Telling the story from 30-plus perspectives of England winning the World Cup 20 years ago. A legacy that was trashed, frankly. And 20 years on, we're talking about an England team at its lowest ebb. Slotty, I read your book in 2 days, and there's so many things. You think, if this team had what that team has, and even a portion of it, they'd be fine.
And I think that the bit that particularly transfers to what we're talking about now is that 2003 team kind of did what we're talking about. There was a point after the Wales game where they went, hey, this is going really badly. Well, we need to do something. We need to address it. And it wasn't described as a revolution or whatever. There was a mature enough environment, and Clive Wilber was a democratic enough leader for the senior players to go, Clive, we're doing this wrong. We need to train differently. And Clive went, fine. And they trained differently and they won a World Cup. So this is where I think this England team is fatally flawed. And I think I put so much of it on the leadership, particularly on Owen Farrell, is who is it who's leading that conversation, who's facilitating it, or are they just protecting their own positions in the team? And because that's how it looks. And at the moment, if Owen Farrell doesn't grasp it and say, we're doing something, it doesn't have to be a 2007 type revolution, whether that was or wasn't, but it doesn't have to be like that. It just has to be mature conversations about how we're getting better. And I get the impression that they don't know how to do that.
Well, fascinating. England-Argentina, 9th of September. Then this coming Saturday is when it all kicks off in Pool D. And we will keep you up to date on that and, of course, all the other pools throughout the World Cup. Next up, we'll finish off our World Cup preview podcast. We'll look at some of our hopes for the tournament and maybe a few predictions as well. All right, let's round things off then. Hopes for the World Cup, predictions of who is going to win it. I'll start with one hope, and I mentioned it at the top of the podcast, actually, is that travel chaos can be avoided as best as possible. I think this is going to be a brilliant World Cup for a whole host of reasons. I'm just a little bit fearful that getting to France and getting around France for us might end up being a little bit difficult, but I'm sure many of the listeners will be sitting at home thinking, I'm not bothered about whether that affects you or not. But that's my hope, is that I can get around France and to France easily enough.
Someone's gonna miss a flight.
I mean, it's Steve, right?
But I was actually more thinking about, they won't miss a flight, but there'll be some sort of travel chaos around a big game, won't there? Like, without being too stereotypical, you've already written a story about it. The French enjoy a strike.
Yeah, and we had it 07 on the day of the final. Train drivers in Paris went on strike. Became really hard for people to get up to the Stade de France. There just will be some chaos around. And the first one that we know of is the second weekend. So England, Japan, and Wales, Portugal on the Friday. There's a air traffic control strike. So England currently faced with a 10-hour train ride down to Nice from Le Touquet, where they're based, unless they can find another plan.
Private jet.
I've got a hope for the tournament, and it's kind of a bit wishy-washy and esoteric, but I just feel that rugby has sustained so many blows as a sport globally over a decade, really. It's really struggling to work out where to go and losing its position, certainly in England, but in many parts of the world. And kind of as we said at the beginning of this podcast, it looks like it could be the best World Cup ever. And I just hope that come the end of October, we're all walking away from Paris just feeling really inspired by the 7 weeks that we just had, and people are going, God, that was amazing, because I just feel that's what it could be, and rugby as a sport just so needs it, and this could be the moment.
I think rugby in our part of the world definitely needs it, and which is why I said at the start that France are the perfect hosts for this tournament, because it is a vibrant sport in France at all levels at the moment. They're not struggling in the way that we're struggling in the UK, certainly in England. So England and Wales. So I think everything is there. Alpha, you've written on our notes here, will officiating take centre stage? That one of the things that will change the conversation that we're all having as we walk away from the World Cup is the impact on red cards and bans. And we think that the drama on the field and the rivalries and the fixtures that are spread out in front of us here on our sheets of paper are extraordinary. It could be wonderful. We all have to accept that there are games and personal stories are going to be impacted massively by red cards, because, as Totti said, one of the massive issues that the game is facing is player welfare and head injuries, and the way that they have chosen to handle it is by dishing out more and more red cards, which means that there are more and more games that are going to be impacted. More and more players will receive 3, 4, 5 match bans, which will end their tournament. I really hope we get the balance right in terms of how the referees officiate the matches and in encouraging the games to be played how we want them to be played. And I just desperately hope that we can be talking about the World Cup being won via some incredible fixtures and not going, well, they won it because the other team were missing 3 players.
One of these massive games is going to be decided because...
Absolutely.
It's just inevitable.
It is inevitable, yeah.
Almost certainly involving South Africa.
Well, you stand by your ex on Twitter, if that's the case.
Razzie.
Yeah, Yakko Johan might have something to say. My hopes and dreams, I think, for all we've said about England, I think a lot of it comes from a place of frustration. If we watch them more than we watch anyone else. And actually, we do want them to do well. Like, it's better to write about when England are better at rugby. So I think one of my hopes is that England play better rugby and play to their potential, because it's just a more enjoyable experience for everyone covering it, going to the games, whatever, who've spent thousands of pounds to go. Doesn't matter about us, but like, that would just make it a more pleasant experience. That's one of mine.
Because to get to Slotty's point, if this, you know, we've had a summer where we've had a sport that has enraptured us and has hit the mainstream, whether it's the women reaching the World Cup final, whether it was the Ashes, the Tour de France, captured people who don't normally follow cycling. If rugby is to do that, there's so much to get excited about this tournament. And as much as we can encourage all rugby fans to get involved in the tournament, and we can talk about Uruguay v Namibia, and we can talk about Fiji v Wales, and we can talk about France v New Zealand on the opening night, it needs England to do something that can excite everyone out the window of this sports bar we're in. If the tournament is going to hit the mainstream and excite people in the way that we've had through the sporting summer up to now, where relatively small-scale sports have really hit the mainstream. Rugby needs it, as Slotty says, but it needs England to perform, really, if that's going to happen.
Can I have 2 more hopes? I don't really... No one, like, we're journalists, we don't really care who wins the World Cup, but I would love France to win the World Cup. It'd be awesome. Like, being in France, covering the World Cup, when France win the World Cup, a Northern Hemisphere winner.
Champs-Élysées.
How cool would that be? That would just be brilliant.
Well, do you remember how it was when they completed the Grand Slam against England a year and a half ago? I mean, that was flipping epic, wasn't it?
Yeah. So we'd like, I mean, we also would, this is not hope, but the sort of, can we never have 9 p.m. kickoffs again, just for our own sanity? It's great for telly, but for us it's awful. But my last hope is, what I should mention a few times, is I really want Fiji to make the semis, because that would just be great. Like, Steve's talked about it on loads of pods and in the paper for about 40 years, but the fact that the top 8 teams have been the same top 8 since Sean Fitzpatrick was playing in 1987 and all that is rubbish. Let's have Fiji getting to the semis. That'd be brilliant.
And to hear how New Zealand won the World Cup in 1987.
Yeah, plug o'clock. Here we go.
Will has released a special How to Win the World Cup series, which we'll be releasing throughout the World Cup. The first episode is already out with Sean Fitzpatrick. We'll have another one being released this coming Thursday. And we've spoken to a member of the winning team from every World Cup winning team. So there's some really interesting chats in there. That'll be on the usual Ruck feed. Let's finish it off, guys. I've put predictions down on the sheet in front of us. But do you know what? Frankly, Slotty, I think what you said for Pool C was absolutely spot on, in that we could probably give you a name, but is anyone here actually confident of predicting who the winner will be? I think it's a great World Cup for that reason, but frankly, I could give you probably 4 different names. All of them could win it, but I'm not sure who's going to.
No, let's do it. Why not? And we'll play them at the end and all look stupid.
Okay, you can start, Will.
France.
South Africa.
So...
So definitive.
No, the only reason is because we were asked this on the pod a couple of weeks ago, when I said I'd put some money on South Africa to win it because the odds were really good before the Rugby Championship, but I thought New Zealand would win it, which is a hard prediction to stick by given what just happened at Twickenham. So I actually do think South Africa right now I've seen best place to win it.
Talk about odds. I got England at 8-1 in February and I was so excited. And you can now get them at like 13.
I remember on the, I wasn't at the Times 4 years ago, but you guys, when you did your predictions, I think
They were great days, weren't they, Alex?
Yeah.
We remember.
Although my dad always keeps the predictions from the start of every Six Nations or World Cup and then phones me up at the end and goes, and like works out who was the most accurate.
Oh, my God. So, yeah, last time, 4 years ago, you all said South Africa. And you were all right. And the other thing was, you know the Chasing the Sun documentary that the Box put out afterwards? They nicked clips of the ruck and put them on as an example of the fawning English going, we're definitely going to win the World Cup. Yeah. When you'd all predicted South Africa were going to win it.
There's a clip of Jonesy saying, oh, they're rubbish, they've got no chance. that was in the week of the final, the two-horse race.
So, Times listeners, these guys know what they're talking about. So if Slotty says South Africa going to win the World Cup, then he has got form and they will.
Hang on, who do we want to be clipped up by after this World Cup? Whose video?
Netflix?
Yeah.
As long as they're paying.
We can speak to them about that. So we've got one France, two South Africans. I think I've already been on TalkSport twice and one time said South Africa and one time said the All Blacks. So I'm jumping all over
You're
this
learning
place.
Well. You just keep changing every time.
Yeah, exactly. I think maybe in the interest of being different on this podcast, I'll go for the All Blacks. But as we've said already, I mean, quite frankly, who knows? And it's going to be brilliant. That has been your ruck preview of the World Cup. We will see you in France the next time that you will be hearing from us. Make sure you catch Will's series of How to Win the World Cup. Make sure you get Slotty's book, The Boys of Winter, recounting 2003 in England's glorious triumph. How long ago that seems now. And also thanks once again to Clubhouse 5 for hosting us for our preview. This has been The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. Make sure you follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. We'll see you in France.
I think we should keep him on, lads. What do you reckon? He's got a future.
He's quite like forceful, though, isn't he?
Professional broadcaster.
He won't let us wander off on down blind avenues. He just keeps dragging it back to the...
He didn't say au revoir at the end, did he?
No.
Things to work on.
Désolé.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.